I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. The physical and mental benefits of exercise are well known. When exercise is done outdoors, there's the added benefit of experiencing the natural world. For most of us, riding a bike, paddling a kayak, or hiking a trail is something we take for granted. For those with physical or cognitive limitations, engaging in these activities and other sports can be a challenge. One solution is adaptive sports. Later in the hour, we'll talk with sight-impaired individuals who've accomplished incredible feats in sailing and hiking. But first, a new adaptive sports program at Nickerson State Park in Brewster. It's a collaboration between Spalding Rehabilitation Network and the Department of Conservation and Recreation. Joining us is Steve Katzenbach. He's a physical therapist at Spalding Adaptive Sports Coordinator who oversees the McGraw Center for Adaptive Sports. Welcome, Steve. Good to see you.
Thank you so much.
And Jane Barber, she's a volunteer with the Adaptive Sports Program and is certified to teach adaptive yoga. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start, Steve, with Spalding has offered an adaptive sports program, but your collaboration with the Department of Conservation and Recreation at Nickerson State Park, this is a first. So tell us more about this collaboration and the establishment of the McGraw Center.
You're right. It is the first. So our history with adaptive sports is many years deep, and we've found the challenge that we were completely full of participants. And that's a good problem to have, but it's also disheartening when you have to say, sorry, we're full. Could you come back next week? So in talks with the Department of Conservation and Recreation through the state, we really stumbled upon a great opportunity. They have a universal access program that is growing, and we've had this strong program all along. We kind of met, had some discussions, and through helping from donors, we were able to, you know, hatch this egg called the McGraw Center, which operates within a state-owned facility and really opens the door to adaptive athletes across the state, not only people who live here, but people who also vacation here. So we really, it was luck and a lot of hard work, but it came out.
So what are the activities that you're offering?
So currently at the McGraw Center, we do a couple activities. We do adaptive cycling, which we have access to trails not only within the park itself, but we also have access to the rail trail, which, you know, people throughout Cape Cod know is a wonderful trail that goes for miles and miles, and it's actually being expanded as we speak right now. We also offer adaptive kayaking. So we have a site right inside the park on Cliff Pond, and we offer kayaking to athletes of all abilities, whether they need seating adaptations or they need to be in a boat with an able-bodied person for stability. We have those options. We also, like speaking to Jane earlier, we have adaptive yoga now. So it opens that other aspect of sport and wellness and holistic into what we offer already.
And is this for all age groups? Does this include children and adolescents as well?
Absolutely. Most of our activities are open to all ages, whether it's equipment specific or not. But our staff also has the ability to adapt our instructions and, you know, rules of whatever sport to include people of all ages as well.
All right. So adaptive yoga. All right, Jane, you're the volunteer at McGraw Center, and you teach us adaptive yoga. So what originally got you interested in adaptive activities?
Oh, well, I am a nurse by training. And as I reached a point in my life where I no longer needed to work for pay in a clinic, I had the good fortune of blending my two passions, which is nursing and sport. So the original entree into adaptive sports for me was teaching adaptive skiing. And as that experience grew, I sought out new opportunities to take that adaptive teaching into the summer. I started living on Cape Cod about 5 years ago, and I sought out the best adaptive center on Cape, and that, of course, took me right to Spalding. And I've been involved with them for about 5 years now. I've really enjoyed working with Steve and all his colleagues. And I live on the tip of the Cape in Provincetown, so, of course, when the dialogue started about opening McGraw, I was delighted, not only because it was closer to home, but because of everything Steve just described. In terms of the adaptive yoga piece, it was almost like a calling for me. A couple years ago, I was working with a veteran ski program, and I was feeling tight. I'm getting older, and I thought, well, if I'm feeling tight, I'm sure people with amputations or using wheelchairs need stretching as well. And I thought, I need to do this. And I was good, lucky enough to have a training essentially fall into my lap. Mm. And just completed that and am so excited to be teaching yoga at the McGraw Center.
So how does that work? You have people of different abilities to do things. So you change the position a little? How does that work?
Well, I think the name of the game is creativity and adaptation. We just taught our first class yesterday, and we had one client who is fairly mobile and yet could not do standing postures, could do things on the ground, but some of the standing postures, we used what we call a yoga chair. Mm. And the other participants were some of our interns who were brand new to yoga. So would present, model the program to meet the need of the client in the chair, and would cue verbally how the interns new to yoga would do it standing.
Hmm, interesting. So, Steve, as you were talking about adapting some of the equipment, and you've got people with varying degrees of you know, somebody maybe have been amputee or somebody else who's, you know, lost an arm. So how are these bikes, let's take the bikes for example, are these things that you can kind of snap on and off? I mean, depending on the person?
Right. So what we have is we have a whole fleet of adaptive cycles that we own. All right. And these cycles are an array of configurations to begin with. And what we do is we look at the individual, the participant. I kind of know their background already through a registration process. And then that person and I have a conversation. Mm-hmm. First, I have to find out why they're there. Do they want to ride 10 miles or do they want to ride for 10 minutes? That's one of our biggest things that we talk about is choosing their own adventure, you know, choosing their own challenge. Mm. As far as the equipment is concerned, we have two basic types of cycles. We have, they're all recumbent, so they're either leg-powered or arm-powered. Mm-hmm. And then depending on what the person's needs are, we kind of go from there. Some people have difficult time transferring in and out of a cycle, but that's why we have extra hands and mm-hmm. we have skilled clinicians that know how to transfer people safely. Mm-hmm. As far as the equipment is concerned, we can snap things on and off. We can also adjust these cycles. They're highly adjustable, whether it's for length or width or changing a pedal. Mm. Sometimes people need a special pedal so their foot doesn't fall off during right. their ride. They're pretty simple. We do it all on the fly if we need to, but we try to prepare as best we can prior to setting off for the morning.
And sports, of course, is a big part of the rehabilitation process for many patients. So what are some of the benefits of using athletic activities over traditional physical therapy that's typically done indoors? Or are you doing both?
We do it both. Mm-hmm. We do it both ways. Obviously, I come from a clinical background. I am a physical therapist by trade. There was a little transition going from my very strict clinical mind to now this more, you know, abstract, open-minded, adaptive sports world. I think the biggest part of it is not only physical recovery from an injury or an illness, but spiritual and emotional. Mm-hmm. Getting them out there in the fresh air, interacting with nature, and getting out there with their family is very important. A lot of traditional rehab, it's you and your therapist or you and your physician. Now it's the individual, their family, some friends, you know, birds,
right,
the wind.
Nature, yeah.
Exactly.
Right. And the whole mental health part of it is, I mean, there's huge studies that talk about what exercise
Absolutely.
Does to the brain and all that.
My experience, having been in the adaptive sports world for about 15 years, is that a lot of healing can come just by playing side by side. Some stories can be shared on a chairlift. The complement to that in the summertime is there's a lot of talking that goes on riding side by side along the rail trail. And the other thing is not only being with family, but the participants sharing with each other. Last year, we had a couple of folk that were both stroke survivors, and it was so fun to watch them talking to each other about what worked, what didn't. Mm. So that's been my experience of the healing power of adaptive sports.
Right. And Steve, often people in recovery after a serious injury are in pain. Many pain medications are opioid-based, and we know opioid addiction is a huge problem. Is there evidence that participating in athletic activities can help reduce pain, or the use of pain medications is less when you're...
Yeah, absolutely. So when participants arrive, I always ask about their pain to begin with. I need to know a baseline reading of how they're feeling that day. I also kind of ask in general, you know, is there anything that makes your pain better or worse? And sometimes I get some information out of that. I also reassess that throughout the cycle or the, you know, kayak trip on the pond. And whether it's power of suggestion or, you know, power of nature or just having camaraderie with other participants, oftentimes they don't bring up the pain that mm-hmm. they were dwelling on earlier that day. And I'm not one to reintroduce it, so I often roll with that.
Yeah, and Jane, what about the sight impaired with the yoga? How do you instruct them to a certain position?
Wow. Well, I haven't had that experience yet, but I know what I would do is I would use my voice. Mm-hmm. I would use verbal cues. And then also, it's important with this population to ask permission mm-hmm. to touch.
Right.
But you could also guide with some gentle touch.
I have a participant who is visually impaired, and her and I do archery.
Oh, really?
Wow, oftentimes people say, oh, that's scary. I'm yeah. like, well, only if you stand between the target and her. We've kind of gone through a progression with her. We started with verbalizing up, down, left, right as she holds the bow. I use some tactile touch feedback to kind of guide her to the target. And I had most recently bought a piece of equipment that gives her guides for foot position and bow the angle of the bow, so she could do it more independently.
Oh.
So we're excited about that.
There's also evidence that individuals with physical limitations who participate in adaptive sports are more likely to gain and maintain employment. What are some of the reasons that we think this is so?
I think just engagement. Oftentimes people who have some type of impairment kind of shelter themselves, whether it's on purpose or maybe their family wants to keep them safe and they stay within their home and they go from doctor's appointment to home. This opens another door, and that door may be, you know, employment in the community, or sometimes they come and volunteer with me, which is an added benefit.
There's something that happens when you see someone that's been a shut-in, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, that comes and participates in our program, especially with some of the longer programs. We just did something called Sport and Spirit, which is an overnight camp. And you might see someone with a very flat affect. Day two, you may see them crack a smile. Day three, you'll see light in their eyes. Mm-hmm. Day four, they'll say, how can I give back? It's a pretty common trajectory that's really, really powerful.
Now, of course, we're beginning of summer here, and this is great time for kayaking and cycling, but then the weather's going to get a little bit cooler. And so do you offer other outdoor adaptive sport activities in the fall and winter, or are you planning that?
We absolutely do. Cycling does run later in the season than kayaking does. We actually do a weekend-long cycling ride on the Vineyard every year. We kind of collaborate with Camp Jabberwocky, and we utilize their facility for overnight stay for our participants. And they have the option of doing a 25 or 50-mile ride both Saturday and Sunday in the fall, which is an amazing event that we've mm-hmm. done for many years now. We also, I mean, Jane was talking about the adaptive ski portion. We do run an adaptive ski clinic up north in a variety of mountains. We have a very robust
sled hockey.
Thank you. Sled hockey program. We actually have a competitive team now called the Boston Shamrocks.
Nice.
So we compete within the region. We actually went to nationals this year to compete.
Wow.
It was very
That's
eye-opening.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So who's eligible to participate in the adaptive sports activities at the McGraw Center?
I'm trying to think of the person who's not able to do it, and I don't think I can answer that question. Mm-hmm. I think everyone and anyone can, whether it's because you're there following an illness or an injury, or you're there with your family, or you're there to participate as a volunteer. I've had participants who've suffered spinal cord injuries or participants who have arthritis, and there's so many things in between that. And I think the better question is, you know, who can't I mm-hmm. adapt the sport to?
My parents were here for the opening of the McGraw Center. They're 89 and 88, and they so enjoyed the recumbent cycles. And I was thinking as we we witness aging now, active aging. People are still in activity in their late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. That's another cohort that I thought that we can really work with. And speaking from the volunteer perspective, the volunteers get as much joy, if not more, out of the program than the clients do. And it really is a family. We all do it together and enjoy it together. It's really a remarkable thing.
Steve Katzenbach, physical therapist who oversees Spalding's McGraw Center for Adaptive Sports, and Jane Barber, adaptive yoga instructor. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
You're
us.
You're welcome.
Coming up after a break, we'll talk with sight-impaired individuals who've accomplished incredible feats in sailing and hiking. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about adaptive sports this hour. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a blind man and an uncle summiting Mount Kilimanjaro. But first, we discuss sailing and skiing for those with vision impairments. Joining us is Amy Bauer, an oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She's part of the World Blind Fleet Sailing Championship team in 2015, who is visually impaired. Welcome back. Good to see you again, Amy.
Yeah, thank you.
Also with us is David Fisichella. He manages shipboard scientific operations at HUI's, and he's trained to guide sight-impaired cross-country skiers and sailors. Welcome back to you as well.
Good morning.
We should mention that you two are married, and you met at an adaptive sports event. I love that story. So these haven't really got good for you. Like, I mean, you never know who you're going to run into.
Right? Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, Amy, you have a degenerative condition, and your sight has deteriorated over a period of time. Was sailing something that you did before you became visually impaired?
Yes, it was. I enjoyed a little bit of dinghy sailing when I was, I grew up in Rockport, Massachusetts. And then I did the Sea Education Association program on a big schooner. Mm-hmm. And my vision was, I didn't know it. It was starting to deteriorate then, but I didn't know it. And I loved the schooner sailing with them.
Yeah. And David, even before you met Amy, you were a sighted guide for blind sailing. How did you become involved in that?
I read an article in a sailing magazine about a blind sailing team in out of the Carroll Center for the Blind in Newton. And more out of curiosity than anything else, I didn't understand how a blind person could sail and race and be competitive. So I called them up just wanting to get some more information, and they immediately recruited me as a sighted guide on the blind sailing group. And that's how we got into that.
Amy, as we mentioned, you were on the World Blind Fleet Sailing Championship team in 2015. So explain how blind sailing worked in this competition.
This is an international competition. There were teams from Great Britain, New Zealand, Canada, the U.S., maybe one other country, I can't remember. And we had four people on a boat. They were, in my fleet, they were sonars, two sighted guides and two blind sailors, one blind sailor on the helm and one trimming, which was me. Mm-hmm. And the sighted guides call out tactics and obstacles mm-hmm. and where the marks are, and but they can't touch anything on the boat in terms of the steering or the sails or anything. Right. So that's up to the blind sailors to manage.
And there are sailing races for the visually impaired that don't use sighted guides but audible tones. So tell us how that works.
Right. That's match racing, very much like the America's Cup works. Two boats on the course, only two boats at a time. And for blind match racing, the marks, which you have to sail towards and circle around, make a specific tone. Also, the boats themselves each make a tone, which is different if you're on a starboard tack or a port mm-hmm. tack. And so you can tell where the other boat is, what tack it's on, which is part of the strategy of match racing, and also where you should be going.
Mm-hmm. So 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I would imagine that could be a little bit scary to start. You know, you've sailed before, but for somebody who's visually impaired and is like, I'm going to sail, do you run across that where some folks are a little bit kind of timid at first?
Absolutely, especially if they haven't ever sailed. I mean, I think for anyone, sighted or not, sailing can be a little unnerving at
sure.
first as the boat heels over, especially. But probably the best way to get over that is to capsize a couple of times and realize that it's a recoverable situation.
Yeah. And so, David, how do you, when you're first, teamed up with somebody and you're working that out, after you're with somebody a few times, they kind of get the program. So how do you begin that process?
Well, first you explore the boat together. You show them where everything is, and let them really get a tactile sense of where things are relative to one another. And probably the most important thing to know about is the boom, for example. Mm-hmm. as most right, sailors yeah. know, an accidental jibe can really do some damage. So you're extra sensitive to that with somebody who can't see the boom coming mm-hmm. across the boat. So, but you try to take it slowly. You go out in conditions that are more benign and get them used to the feel of the boat and try to engage all the senses in terms of sound. You know, what does the boat sound like going through the water? And the wind on the face, mm-hmm. where's the wind coming from? When you're put somebody who's blind at the helm, you just try to show them, give them that feedback. What are the results of their actions when they do something, mm-hmm. Whether it's loosening the sails or moving the tiller? So it's a slow process, but like any learning anything else new, you just find ways to describe what's going on around, and people tend to get it pretty quickly. Yeah.
You are also trained as a guide for visually impaired cross-country skiers, so tell us about the training that you received to do that.
I participated in a program, and still do, it's been quite a number of years now, a program called Ski for Light, and that was a program started about almost 50 years ago here in the United States. It was brought over to the United States from a very similar program developed in Norway. And initially it's to bring blind and visually impaired people into the world of cross-country skiing and expose them to that kind of sport. And it's developed over the years to not only people who've never skied before, in some cases people who've never seen snow before, mm-hmm. To people who are Paralympic class skiers. It's a week-long event that's held in different places around the country, and they pair sighted guides up with blind and visually impaired and mobility impaired skiers as well for a week of just skiing and at the end and racing at the end of the event. It's a program that will teach you to be a guide. They provide all the necessary training that you need. And it's done in a way that it's very safe for the skiers. The way if for anybody who's cross country skied before, we use it's the classic Nordic style. It's not skate skiing. It's in track, mm-hmm. so we tend to groom the tracks very deep, so a visually impaired skier can put their skis in the track and be fairly well
feel it, yeah.
feel mm-hmm. what's happening. Of course, there are always hills up and down that sure. you have to contend with, which is if you're blind, if you've never been experienced blind skiing, just close your eyes going down even the slightest incline right. on skis, and you see how terrifying
scary.
That
I know,
can
right?
be.
So I was just thinking, what are some of those things that are really important to communicate to your partner that those with vision might not even be thinking of?
You definitely want to make them aware of the terrain, what's going to happen in advance. People don't want to be surprised, and you try to prepare them for what's coming up. Also, it's a challenge. A balance is a challenge for someone without vision. So you learn to develop those skills. The rest of it is really communication. There are a number of standard commands that you're taught for certain things, and probably the most important command as a blind guide that you can give a skier is what they call a sit command. It sounds rather derogatory,
I was thinking it would
but
be stop.
Well, it accomplishes the same thing.
It's the universal command that says, "Hey, there's something ahead that we need to deal with right now. Just
sit down.
Sit down.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
you'll stay out of trouble." But there's a variety of different commands that you're taught for different situations, and when you're racing, it's you can be going quite fast.
Sure.
And for a blind skier or a blind person, that freedom of movement mm-hmm. to be able to go that fast without worrying about hitting something,
right.
that sense of motion is something that a lot of people don't get to experience.
That's right. Yeah. Let's talk to Russ, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning. How are you, Mindy?
Good.
I should mention, I'm listening to your program, and I should mention one of the adaptive sports is quite interesting is wheelchair curling.
Oh, right.
We have a curling club here in Falmouth. We believe we are the largest wheelchair curling membership in the country. Hmm. And three of our wheelchair curlers in the past have gone to the Olympics and the Paralympics in Russia and Korea.
Wow, that's exciting.
And, we welcome wheelchair people to our club. We are starting July 6th, our annual largest off-season curling tournament in the world. It goes July 6th to about the 25th. I don't have my calendar in front of me, But that last weekend is dedicated for wheelchair curlers that come in from all over the world. And we'd be delighted to invite wheelchair users to come down and see it. And then in the fall, when we put our ice back in, we welcome and encourage wheelchair users to come down and be part of our club.
Right.
So if anyone is interested, they can just Google Cape Cod Curling or go to capecodcurling.org and get in touch with us. We'd be delighted to have more wheelchair people at our club.
All right, Russ, thanks for sharing that. That's, and if and Russ has actually gotten me out there to try curling, and it really is a lot of fun. Russ, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So as I'm hearing you talk about this relationship with as a guide and Amy as the visually impaired, there's got to be a lot of trust here, right? I mean, you're talking about sometimes going pretty fast and not worrying about, you know, hitting into something. You've got to really trust this person.
Yeah, definitely. And that takes some time to build up. And I, especially with a beginner blind skier, the guide has to go slowly at first so that that trust can build up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things is part of the training regimen. Mm-hmm. Before you're allowed to guide blind skiers, you're paired up with other sighted guides in training. And one of the exercises is to blindfold one person and try to guide them. So as a guide, you get the opportunity to ski for a few hours blindfolded, and that creates a lot of empathy.
So what do you find makes a good sighted guide, and what are the kind of qualities? Like if somebody listening going, hey, that sounds like I might be interested in that, what do you look for when you're looking for a guide?
Be able to verbalize your right from your left quickly.
And accurately.
And I say that only
know
because
your right from your left. Okay.
I say that only because Amy can attest that I don't always do that correctly.
He'll say he's one of those people who gets it mixed up sometimes, which can be quasi-catastrophic.
But I think the ability to teach and be patient and just have a passion for what you do. I got into this really not to be a guide for blind people as much as to share this, you know, the sport of cross-country skiing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a really altruistic endeavor for me. It's something that I enjoy.
In fact, in that event, it's both the guides and the blind participants pay the same amount. Mm. So it's a real partnership. It's not a charity in a way. And I think that many of the sighted guides get just as much out of it as the blind participants.
Yeah. What about, Amy, as the person who's visually impaired, and you go to an event where there isn't any, you're the only, you kind of like, all eyes are on you. It's like, oh, this blind woman is going to sail a boat.
Right.
But when you're with, like, these competitions you're talking about, you're all in the same
boat.
All in the same boat, right.
Yeah, no, and with the skiing, too, it's very liberating, I think, because in my profession as an oceanographer, I am typically, not always, but often, the only blind scientist for miles around.
Right.
And that's an all-eyes-on-you kind of situation sometimes. But in these events, it's not that way, and it's a tremendous relief.
It must be exhilarating.
It is. And to have an event that is set up for me and for my particular needs is just great, really freeing. And then you can focus on the competition and the event and the activity and not the blind part of it so much, you know.
And I think David mentioned this earlier about going fast, one of those experiences that people with visual impairments often miss out on. Sailing obviously is one of those sports that's allowed you to experience speed, and I would guess skiing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and the sailing, you know, it's there's some jeopardy involved, which makes it exciting. And skiing also, you know, sometimes we have collisions at marks. Sometimes we hit the marks and, you know, it's but it's not life threatening.
Right.
Most of the time. But it's exciting.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the physical benefits of the exercise itself. Right. And then as we talked about, the camaraderie between, you know, the people that you meet. And so there's
there's a big issue with fitness level in general amongst visually impaired and probably people with other disabilities as well, just because of the lack of opportunity to move the body in a safe and free way. And so these sports and others provide that opportunity.
Right. We're talking about adaptive sports this hour. Coming up after a break, we'll talk with a visually impaired man and his sighted uncle who recently summited Mount Kilimanjaro. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing adaptive sports this hour with Amy Bauer. She was part of the World Blind Fleet Sailing Championship team in 2015. And David Fisichella, who is a trained guide to sight-impaired cross-country skiers and sailors. Joining us on the phone now is Tim Connors. He's a recent graduate of Ithaca College who recently summited Mount Kilimanjaro and is visually impaired. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And in studio is Tim's uncle, Dr. Robert McGowan, a Falmouth doctor who made the journey along with Tim. Welcome to you.
Thanks for inviting us.
All right, so Tim, what were some of the reasons you wanted to make this ascent of Kilimanjaro?
There were a lot of reasons. One of them was, despite having faced cancer and blindness in my life, I really wanted to push on to go do something after I had done the Grand Canyon, like the 9.5-mile Bright Angel Trail out in 2014. But more importantly, I wanted to make a statement that it doesn't really matter what we face in our lives. We have the opportunity still to go on and do some amazing things. And I think we've really been able to do that with our climb.
Mm-hmm. All right. Bob, Tim asked you to join this team on his ascent, primarily in the role of physician. What were your first thoughts when he said, "Hey, Uncle Bob, I want you to do this with me"?
So there have been many conversations that Tim and I have had. The first one, obviously, was I said to him, "You're crazy, and this is not something you should be considering doing at all because of all of the limitations that Tim has. He has the blindness. He is a cancer survivor. He also has peripheral neuropathy left over from his chemotherapy. So I could not envision him doing this climb. And now having done it, and realizing what was involved, I'm even more amazed that he was able to do it and that we were able to do it. But he put together an amazing team.
Yeah. So Tim, you came to him with a plan. You said, "Here's how we're going to do this."
Yeah, I had put together a different team, really started summer of 2015 putting things together. And, you know, at points we were thinking, I was scratching my head thinking, what's going on here? But, you know, we put it all together and it ended up being, as my uncle said, you know, at points we weren't even sure, but, you know, we ended up doing it, and it's amazing.
And so this mountain climbing was not really something that was on your agenda, Bob, right? So he says, "Well, we're going to go climb Mount Kilimanjaro." So you probably did some research. So tell us, how high is this? What's the terrain that you're going to be hiking through?
I should have done more research, but yes. The climbing Kilimanjaro, we reached the peak. There are three peaks actually at the top. We reached the peak of 18,800 feet. And when you get up to that altitude, oxygen demand is a significant challenge. Some of the terrain, there was no technical climbing, but there were definitely areas of challenging terrain where we had to reach for different rock holds with our hands and our feet in order to be able to continue the climb. Tim had as amazing abilities on his own to be able to do this. He also had some young men with us, Robert Brace and Alec, I'm blanking on his last name, but that were able to help with a lot of the climbing. There are also mountain guides that were tremendously helpful in some of the more dangerous areas.
Yeah, Tim, so you had several sighted guides on this trip. Give us a sense of the kinds of information that your guides shared with you as you were moving up the mountain.
I think the biggest information was the shifts in terrain. I really feel that it's kind of like, just imagine closing your eyes and going forward, and then you big rock in the path, or okay, we got one in the middle, we got this coming up, okay, we're going to have to do a big step here, okay, I'm going to have you drop your poles, we got to go with our hands, just so much information to be relayed, and as my uncle knows, I like to be a talker, so I'd really stress being quiet on this climb to really focus and really, take in the information that my team was giving me, because it was so crucial in order to succeed and continue to move on.
Yeah, and this, I mean, climbing a mountain, like Amy, you were talking earlier, sailing, you fall in the water, no big deal. It's not life-threatening. Same thing with the skiing, but climbing a mountain, a false step there, and you could be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. There were definitely a couple of areas. I mean, much of the hike is actually a gradual terrain, and the trail is fairly well marked in a way that it's clear where you're going forward. Many people climb Kilimanjaro, but there were definitely several areas within that they were challenging. And as I said, in some ways, there are several times that I said, you know, I'm glad Tim can't see because this is scary. I was going to say one of the things that I've come to think about as I've been processing, we actually used several different trials of adaptive approaches with Tim. One common thing that people who are blind use is a bell to help with kind of with location. And we also tried tapping the walking hiking poles to help with that location. And I think we realized, and Tim can comment on this, that that was not as helpful for him and mm-hmm. was not helpful in terms of the way he needed to climb. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Tim, a little bit, how that worked and or didn't work.
Yeah, we started off using some of the methods like my uncle had mentioned. For some reason, and I weren't, you know, not quite sure, but the echo or something that was ringing off of the bells, it really was catching my ear weird. So I would end up, you know, pointing myself in a different kind of direction. And so some of the techniques that I had used at home and been able to do, I really had to be like, okay, you know, this is what I did, but I'm going to have to not do this here in order to succeed. You know, it's hard. You know, you've been training and you have the system down and it's like, okay, not working. What are we going to do next? Mm-hmm. And that's part of the adaptable sports, like was mentioned earlier, is that, you know, it is the trial and error and that perseverance to really just say, okay, this isn't working. We're going to try a new method. Mm-hmm. And I think that's on the person who's helping out, but also the person who's doing it, to have that flexibility and just say, okay, we're going to figure it out. It's just this method may not have worked.
Right. Creativity. You got to be creative. Tim, I'm wondering, before you did this hike, you obviously did some research too. Did you know what you were getting into? I mean, as far as what the terrain would be and the challenges?
I think that's a twofold question for me. it's the fifth mountain I've ever summited. So really when I had brainstormed in 2015, I had never really summited a mountain, but yet I was going to climb the highest in Africa. But I think I underestimated in some ways that I trained really hard and I was in great shape for it. But what was all the other things, like my uncle had mentioned that my body has dealt with post-cancer, they really came to the forefront when we climbed. The temperatures were very hard on my body, all the different shifts, waking up and having the extreme nausea and just things that, you know, I didn't necessarily think of, because in a lot of ways, I just like to think at this point, you know, 7 years out, that it's mostly the blindness that would be my biggest obstacle. So when those things really kicked in hard, it was like the curb from where I was to where I dropped down to was very steep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our ability to maintain balance is aided in large part by sight. So, Tim, what are some of the ways you've adapted to maintain your balance, particularly when you're hiking over that rough terrain?
Well, yeah, I laugh because they say that it's your sight, your feet, and your hearing. And with the neuropathy from the knees down, I don't really have too much feeling with the feet. And the sight's gone. So for me, the balance has always been a tricky one. And I honestly am very thankful for my personal trainer, Leroy, that I worked with, you know, probably really intense the 4 months leading up to the climb, because we really worked on some of these balance things and we broke through and I'm able to do some things that I wasn't able to do, you know, 4 months before the climb, but it was so crucial. And that's why it even helped out, because as my body got more tired and tired, the little problems I had seemed to become bigger and bigger. And so having my team and, as my uncle mentioned, my friends Robert and Alex, you know, being able to sometimes guide me or maybe give me a push up so we could keep going, you know, those things that weren't necessarily the blindness, but were things that I needed in order to succeed. So it's just different with the multifaceted kind of disabilities and everything going on. But yeah, balance definitely ran into a problem sometimes. I remember I was tired after a long day's hike. I went to lean over and I thought we were there and I misstepped and I landed and they're like,
wow, you almost just landed on a cactus. And I said, there's no cactus. Then I reached my hand over to get up. I'm like, okay, there's a cactus.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Bob, what did you find the most challenging about the hike?
You know, for me, it was I have been to Colorado a number of times skiing, and so I had a sense of what the altitude stress would be like. I did not really have a sense for what it's like when you're consistently above 13 or 14,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And I definitely had some component of altitude sickness when I was at the summit. There are things I don't remember about being up there. And one of the things I remember is kind of like Tim's dad, kind of just saying, let me get out of here now. This is it. We're good.
We've done it.
Right. The temperature also was, Tim had alluded to it, when you get up, even though you're only a few degrees from the equator, above 10,000, 12,000 feet, it was cold at night, very cold. And getting up in the morning, kind of getting everything going was a real challenge. Fortunately, I had kind of prepared for that. If some of the outfits that I'm wearing in the pictures are kind of silly looking, but honestly, it was just every piece of clothing I could possibly put on.
How long was the trip?
So the whole trip was, I don't know what it was, 13 days, Tim, where we actually started at a school, the K2 Adventure organization that Tim partnered with, which was actually one of the great keys to success, has an association with a school for the blind in Tanzania. So we spent a couple days there, partly acclimating, partly working with the kids and just helping in ways that we could in the school. And then from there, we went to the climb. And the climb, I keep saying it took us 7 days up and 2 days down. I think that's right, Tim. You can correct it. You know, the days kind of blurred together for me.
Is that right, Tim?
It was 8 days to summit, but on the summit day, we came down almost, 12,000 feet?
Yeah.
And then the last day was day nine, was through the rainforest.
Yeah, running down.
Right. Yeah.
So, Tim, you lost your sight as a teenager from cancer, and since then you've made a wilderness trip down the Colorado River. You've done the ascent of Mount Kilimanjaro. Why are these activities important to you, and what advice would you give to someone who's also facing physical challenges?
Well, I really feel that it's not necessarily, as I say, mountain impossible. It's not about me climbing a mountain. It's really just about that idea of pushing outside of your comfort zone. I'm a motivational speaker by trade, and I really try to empower people to think outside the box and really push themselves, because in a lot of ways, I was at that point when I said, okay, it's cancer. Okay, I think I'm going to make it through this. Okay, now I've got the blindness. And then when I entered the ICU, heart, lung, kidney failure, and I don't even remember any of this, and then coming back and thinking, what does life have in store for me? I'm not going to be able to do anything. And then getting inspiration, you know, Eric Weinmayer, who's blind and climbed the 7th summit, including Everest, you know, when I met him on my Make-A-Wish, and you know, he told me I could do anything. I'm like, I want to be like this guy. Mm-hmm. And getting out into nature and doing these things, it's not necessarily that it has to be the rock climbing. You know, there's all these, you know, sailing, everything that's been mentioned. But getting out and pushing yourself and not letting your limitations get the best of you and being able to really just go do what you want, but know you can do it really well and you can go as far with it as you choose.
I'm going to say very inspiring. I mean, he's talking about his inspiration, but I would say, Tim, that you are an inspiration to a lot of people. And I love the, you know, go outside of your comfort zone. That's true for anybody, you know, whether you have, you know, a physical challenge or not. Do you have any more adventures in mind for yourself? Are you going to get your uncle involved in something else that he's going to be like, oh boy, what are we doing next?
Well, I keep him on the edge for that one. he's like, maybe I'll sit off the next one.
Exactly. I think he hasn't mentioned anything, and that's probably a good thing.
Well, I was worried he was going to say the toughest thing was tenting with me. You know, I like my systems and lots of room. So.
he is nodding his head, I will tell you. So, Amy, not every... go ahead, Tim. Did you want to finish? Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Really, right now, it's just continuing to fundraise. You know, in addition to climbing, my big goal was to raise a lot of money, $500,000, for charities and organizations to help me with disability, with cancer, and everything. So not only I could be here today alive, but to go on and be successful. And I feel like it's my responsibility to pay it forward to those organizations, because there are going to be other Tim Connors out there in the world that are facing these problems. Mm-hmm. And because I had so much support, you know, as we say, you know, Mountain Impossible, this was a team effort. This wasn't just me. And I want that really emphasized, because so many people have played a role. And I wanted them to know when we summited that that was as much them, my doctors, everybody along the way, the organization. And that's why we continue to raise. And that's my big goal as of right now. And I'm sure I'll come up with some other adventure thing in the future. Mm-hmm. But right now, I really want to focus on that, because that was a key reason for doing this, was the giving back.
Right. And as Tim was mentioning, team effort, Amy, you were nodding your head.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Over here. And not everyone with physical challenges are ready to sign up for a wilderness adventure. Tim is doing, but they might be willing to try some of the adaptive sports programs that are being offered by the McGraw Center. And so what is your advice for somebody listening that might have a challenge and going, well, maybe I'd like to try that?
At some point, you just have to step out. Have courage and step out and try something at whatever comfort level you can manage to start with. And I think someone in that situation will quickly find, like, I can do this. Mm-hmm. And there are people around to help and support, and that it will only propel itself forward from there.
Right. And I would think that anybody who's tried probably would say it's a positive experience. There aren't many people who've done this who say, you know, that was not worth my time.
Right. Yeah. No, definitely not.
Yeah. If I can reiterate something that Tim said, the motto of Ski for Light is, if I can do this, I can do anything. Mm-hmm. Now, that may be a stretch in some level, but what it does for a lot of people is it shows them that, hey, I did something that I didn't think I could do before, and where can I go next? It's a stepping stone. And a lot of people who go through the Ski for Light program go on to do many, many other things in adaptive sports, and both personally and professionally. So it's
Tim, what advice do you give folks who might have some challenges in thinking and listening to this and thinking, can I do that?
Well, I think we have to be real in the fact that sometimes it's not easy. You do fall on your face a little, but you got to laugh. My example of this is I did adaptive skateboarding. Now, I mentioned the balance is a problem. So we go down, and I'm going, and I'm like, how big was that ramp? Tim, it was only 2 feet. And I'm thinking I've gone down like the 6-foot ramp. But it's just those things where I found the positive attitude and just laughing, because, you know, sometimes you got to get back up, you fall. Right. But in the end, you know, like everyone said, you know, it's worth it. And I love the motto they just mentioned, you know, be able to do anything. You know, my nickname's Tim Possible, and I really try to, you know, live that motto. It's impossible until you do it. It's the name of my book. And I really try to, you know, push people that, you know, it's only impossible if you think so, and it's only impossible until you've done it. You know, that was Kilimanjaro, and there were points even on the climb we weren't sure, but we ended up doing it. And I think it's that attitude that'll propel anybody forward, whether they are someone with a disability or not.
Right. And we should mention Bob and Tim will have a PowerPoint presentation and a potluck dinner next Tuesday, June 27th, at the First Congregational Church in Falmouth. That potluck dinner at 6 p.m., the presentation at 6:30. We'll have more information about Tim and Bob's ascent of Kilimanjaro and sailing opportunities for the visually impaired at our website, capeandislands.org. Amy Bauer, David Fisichella, Tim Connors, and Bob McGowan, thanks so much for joining us. Keep going.
Thank you.
I'm anxious to hear what you all have to do next. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.